The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. remains one of the most recognized names in the world. His life and his words have been extensively studied. And personally, I preached an MLK weekend sermon each year since I arrived here at UUCF more than a decade ago. At some point, you might wonder, is there anything new left to say? As a minister originally trained in the Christian tradition, let me assure you that after 2,000 years, for better or worse, people have not run out of things to say about Jesus. And as an authorized meditation teacher, it's also clear that after more than 2.5 millennia, people still have plenty to say about the Buddha as well. And so it is with world historical figures like Dr. King. They tend to be this endless source of inspiration and debate. Still, when I heard that a new 600-page biography was being published about Dr. King, I found myself thinking, does the world really need another giant biography of King? Well, it turns out the answer is yes. The Washington Post, so out of the huge number of books published every year, right? The Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, Time Magazine, and the Smithsonian Magazine all named this book, Jonathan Eig's King Alive, as one of their 10 best books of 2023. The Washington Post reviewer called it the single most compelling account of King's life in a generation. The New York Times deemed it the new definitive biography. So in the wake of these rave reviews, I relented. And even though I have read thousands of pages of primary and secondary sources about King over the past 20 years of professional ministry, I found many parts of this biography riveting. How many of you have read it? I know a few people. Okay, I see a hand here or there. Great. I had access to thousands of recently released FBI documents and tens of thousands of other new items. That's part of what makes this so significant. He also conducted hundreds of interviews with people who knew King and who were finally willing to speak more openly than ever due to the passage of time. As a result, Eig was able to write the most honest, transparent, and humane biography of King ever written. Now, when we think of King, some of the images that for many of us spring immediately to mind are of him as one of the most gifted, charismatic, and prophetic public speakers who has ever lived. But did you know that King also loved to play pool? In that spirit of wanting to tell a fuller truth about King's life, Eig has attempted to recover the real man from the gray mist of hagiography. Too many previous accounts of King have focused only on the holy parts of his life and have left out his humanity. In Eig's words, King was a man, not a saint. You know, Dorothy Day used to say, "Don't call me a saint. Don't dismiss me that easily." King was a man, not a saint, not a symbol. He chewed his fingernails. He shouted at the TV during quiz shows. He hid his cigarettes from his children. He had a little dog named Topsy. His skin was so sensitive that he couldn't use a razor. He slept poorly, but he napped well. He ran chronically late for meetings. As an adolescent, he twice attempted suicide, though perhaps half-heartedly. As an adult, he was hospitalized repeatedly. He called it for exhaustion. Others described it as depression. He possessed a wicked sense of humor, improved by the knowledge that certain jokes are just funnier coming from a Baptist minister. He depended on his wife, Coretta, in ways that few people understood at the time. He also cheated on her, continually, even when he knew the FBI was tapping his phones, bugging his hotel rooms, and trying to destroy his marriage and his reputation. He maintained one intimate relationship for so long that friends referred to the woman as his second wife. He was a man also, though, who announced at an early age that God had called him to act. And he was tragically right when he predicted that his commitment to social, racial, and economic justice was putting his life at risk, and that it would probably cost him his life. There's so much to say about this new biography of King. I'll have to limit myself to just a few highlights that give you glimpses of the human King behind the headlines. And it may inspire some of you to read some or all of this for yourself. Let's begin by turning back the clock to King as a young student. He enrolled in the historically black Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia in 1944 at the precocious age of 15. This photo is from his college graduation 4 years later, so he was only 19 when he entered Crozier Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania. In his third year of divinity school, King dated his first and only white girlfriend, Betty Moitz. Their relationship was during the 1950 to 1951 school year. That's a decade and a half before the 1967 Supreme Court decision, Loving versus Virginia, which struck down state laws against interracial marriage. Keep in mind that King was killed in 68, so just a year, less than a year after that ruling. Since the young couple was in Pennsylvania, interracial dating was not illegal. Pennsylvania is one of those states in green that was at the forefront of repealing anti-miscegenation laws in the late 19th century. The states in gray never had laws against interracial marriage, and the ones in yellow repealed their laws at various points in the two decades prior to the Supreme Court decision in 67. But see, King wanted to be a minister in the South, in that swath of red states that refused to allow interracial marriage until the Supreme Court forced them to. King wanted to propose to Betty, but his mentor, the Reverend Pius Barber, warned that marrying a white woman would wreck his career, regardless of whether he lived in the North or the South. Barber said that King never recovered fully from that breakup. Harry Belafonte, who became King's close friend years later, echoed that she had been King's true love. He never stopped thinking about Betty, never stopped talking about her, especially with Belafonte, who himself was married to a white woman. Betty ended up getting married a few years later, became a successful interior decorator and antique dealer, and had three children. She said that from her perspective, "I wouldn't actually say that King was brokenhearted. I would actually say he was probably more angry. Angry that he would have feelings for someone and that he couldn't go ahead and do what he wanted to do because of the race situation." Now, I bring up this history, as does Eig in his book, out of no disrespect for Coretta Scott King, who obviously was profoundly and deeply influential on Dr. King, but rather in a spirit of transparency of all that King was wrestling with in his private life behind the headlines, all that he was having to deal with, as well as trying to change the world. And while I'm on the topic of King's relationships, it is true that King had affairs, and Eig goes into some of the details, but more importantly, I want to underscore that the more important takeaway is much less King's private behavior and much more the perverse circumstances under which how we learned about them and how that they became public. No matter how strongly King stressed the American values of his movement, no matter how often he quoted from the Constitution, the Bible, and from patriotic songs, he was still perceived and treated as a threat to national security. No one within the FBI or the Kennedy administration suggested that maybe the law enforcement ought to be protecting civil rights leaders and leaders of the movement rather than investigating and undermining them. When the FBI released thousands of pages from their secret files on King, and not all of them have been released, they won't be fully released until 2027, there was no evidence that emerged to suggest that communist operatives controlled or manipulated King. The biggest revelation of those thousands of pages of FBI reports was probably the extent and the determination of the FBI's campaign to thwart King. There's so much more I'd like to say, but I'm going to have to limit myself to three more quick examples. First, it can be easy to assume that Dr. King arrived on the world stage fully formed. But tracing the evolution of his views is one of the most fascinating parts of reading through his full story chronologically. In early 1956, only a few weeks into the Montgomery bus boycotts, if you had visited Dr. King's home, you would have found armed guards out front, and you would have found a pistol sitting in his living room. Soon, however, he became convinced that nonviolent activism was ultimately a more powerful method of social change. King disposed of his gun and ordered the men guarding his home to do so unarmed. A second fascinating insight into the human king is that although he was incredibly dedicated to his work and kept up what can only be called a brutally intense travel schedule, he did have his limits. When he was on the road, he could more easily reuse and rearrange old material for new audiences. But as a minister who has the challenge to come up with new material, right, every week for the same audience, I can't help but smile in sympathy when I read about King's confession to his congregation when he realized he was in the middle of preaching the same sermon to them for the third year in a row. Honestly, though, most of King's sermons I could probably listen to three times in a row, much less like 3 years in a row. Third, I discovered a significant revelation from rereading the unedited transcript of Alex Haley's 1965 interview with Dr. King, which was published in Playboy magazine. Yes, that Playboy magazine. That article contains what was believed to be King's harshest and most famous criticism of Malcolm X. According to Haley, King accused Malcolm X of fiery, demagogic oratory. That quote significantly contributed, has for decades, to this public perception of a wide gulf between the two civil rights leaders. But when I went back to the original, he discovered that some of King's words were significantly out of context, while others appeared to have been fabricated by Haley. Haley records King denouncing Malcolm X's fiery demagogic oratory in the black ghettos, urging Negroes to arm themselves and prepare to engage in violence. King did say that phrase, but he said it 48 pages earlier than when he was talking about Malcolm X. It was not about Malcolm X at all. It was instead in response to a more general question about people urging violence. Likewise, according to Haley, King says, quote, "I feel that Malcolm has done himself and our people a great disservice." King doesn't say that or anything like it anywhere in the entire 84-page interview. This photo is from 1964 at the U.S. Capitol. It's the only time that the two men met in person. As we explored a few years ago in a service on Martin, Malcolm, and America, toward the end of their respective lives, Malcolm X was becoming an increasingly savvy political operative open to building coalitions with white allies, and Dr. King was becoming an increasingly radical social prophet. They were coming closer together, not farther apart. Before I move to my conclusion, I want to invite you to hear just some of Jonathan Eig's summation from the end of his magisterial new biography of Dr. King. Today, almost 1,000 cities and towns in the United States have streets named in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. More than 100 public schools bear his name. In Washington, D.C., we have now a King Memorial that stands within sight of Lincoln and Jefferson along the National Mall's Tidal Basin. It is the only national monument in Washington dedicated to a person of color. But in hallowing King, we have too often hallowed him. Along those streets named after MLK, poverty and segregation rates remain much higher than national and local averages. In those schools named for King, and in almost every school in America, King's life and lessons are often smoothed and polished beyond recognition of all that King actually said. Young people hear his dream of brotherhood and his wish for children to be judged by the content of their character, but they do not hear his call that the fundamental character of our country needs to change. Nor his cry for an end to the triple evils of materialism, militarism, and racism. I observed that on his most recent visit to the King Memorial in D.C., this was in the spring of 22, none of King's books were for sale in the gift shop. If one of you makes it to that gift shop again before me, report back. I want to know, has this book caused them to start stocking King's book? I suspect it has, but I don't know. If you're wondering about what I would suggest if you were to start at one place, it's a book titled The Radical King. It's a collection of his writings published a few years ago by our own Beacon Press, owned by the Unitarian Universalist Association. It's a very powerful place to start to hear King for yourself. I concludes, today's King's words might help us make us our way through these troubled times, but only if we actually read them. Only if we embrace the complicated King, the flawed King, the human King, the radical King. In that spirit, I want to conclude for now with a meditation on a very human moment from the near the end of King's life. On Thursday, April 4th, 1968, just a few moments before 6 o'clock p.m., the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. stepped out of room 306 at the Lorraine Hotel in Memphis to the second-story balcony. The temperature was in the mid-50s, and Dr. King was dressed in his usual dark suit. He had on a conservative yellow and black tie. He was preparing to go to a party at the home of Reverend Billy Kiles, a local minister in Memphis. There had been some conflict between King and Reverend Jesse Jackson in the preceding days, and when King saw Jackson in the parking lot, he shouted, "Jesse, I want you to come to dinner with me." Before Jesse could respond, Kiles said, "Oh, Jesse already took care of that." Jackson was intending to go to that dinner, whether Dr. King wanted him to or not. King, though, not to be outdone, added, "Jesse, we're going to Billy Kiles. You don't even have a tie on." Jackson had on his standard turtleneck and a jacket. Jackson quipped back, "The prerequisite to eating is an appetite, not a tie." King laughed and said, "You're crazy." King then turned to Ben Branch, the band leader, who was beside Jackson. He said, "Ben, I want you to play Precious Lord for me tonight." It was one of King's favorite songs. He would have known it had been originally written by a hymn writer, deeply in grief over the death of his wife and son. King said, "Sing it real pretty." Branch assured him, "I sure will." Before King could say another word, a bullet hit him, and he fell. It was 6:01 p.m.
"Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, help me stand."
Only days before, Dr. King chose to return to Memphis to be in solidarity with the sanitation workers' strike. He had been offered what was once his dream job, a much-deserved one-year sabbatical as the interim pastor of New York City's Riverside Church, renowned for its commitment to social justice. If he had accepted that offer, he would not have been in Memphis that night.
"I am tired.
On April 4th, 1967, precisely one year before he was assassinated, Dr. King had ascended to that historic Riverside pulpit and preached what was his most radical sermon, Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence.
"Through the storm, through the night."
He declined that offer of sabbatical because it would have taken him too far away from the front lines of social justice.
"Lead me on through the line."
If King were alive today, he would be celebrating his 95th birthday tomorrow. I'm always shocked to remember he was 39 years old when he was killed.
"Take my hand.
Share words from a contemporary community organizer. King's leadership today remains a North Star. He taught us not about a sterile civility, but about revolutionary love.
"When my way grows drear."
King showed us that we can engage in fierce conflict, marching, sitting in, boycotting, going on strike, shutting it down, and still love and respect our opponents, even those who hate and seek to harm us. We do this not because it is nice or comfy and proper. We do it because it is powerful.
"Precious Lord, lead me near."
When King was assassinated, he was in the midst of organizing a multiracial poor people's campaign to confront what he called the triple threats that most consistently hold us back from actually building the beloved community that we dream about: racism, poverty, and militarism. If he were alive today, he would surely have added climate change and ecological devastation to that list. Keep in mind, King was killed before the first Earth Day.
When my life is almost gone.
King's challenge for us today is to follow his example in our own time, to lead with love, to disagree with mutual respect, and to prioritize the suffering of those who are most oppressed. When King was killed in Memphis supporting striking black sanitation workers, garbage men, two of whom had been crushed to death by a trash compactor in their fight for basic dignity.
And the river stand.
If you truly wish to honor King's life and legacy, ask yourself, what would he do now?
Guard my feet.
We are called to lead with love at the center. Rather than assuming the worst in others, we must reach graciously for the good in them. Dr. King always sought what he called a double victory, in which even the white supremacists who threatened his life might also be redeemed. Our challenge in turn is to rise above the toxicity of our present political moment. We are called to show what principled, generous, mature leadership with our eyes on the prize of political revolution looks like. We do so for our democracy, for our planet, and for the just multicultural America that we dream about. As King said, we are confronted by the fierce urgency of now.
Take my hand, precious Lord, and lead me home.
Dr. King was taken from us too soon, but his legacy lives on. It is our time now to continue the work he called us to of building the world we dream about, a world with peace and liberty and justice, not merely for an elite few, but truly and finally for all.